Okay, I think it's recording now. So,
sure, very good. So, how are you, Vance?
I'm fine. I'm Vance Stevens in Al Ain, United Arab Emirates. Who am I talking to?
Zahra Shafi. I'm Zahra Shafi from Iran, and I'm researching on call teacher education.
Uh-huh, okay. And let's see, Suzanne Mirandi asked you to get in touch with me. Is she your advisor?
Yes. She's my supervisor, my dissertation supervisor, and yes, she mentioned that your experience and knowledge in computer-assisted language learning will be a great contribution to the research.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'm happy to help. I'm happy to be talking with
you. Thank you so much. Thank you, and thank you so much for accepting it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. And shall I ask some questions, first of all, about your some biographical questions? For example, how long have you been teaching teachers, in fact? How long have you been integrating technology in your teaching?
Okay. You asked me if you could answer questions, and then I was going to say yes. And then you asked questions, maybe one at a time. But first of all, before I do that, could I ask you... It's the 27th of April, 2018. I like to tell people, I like to put that on recordings. And what is your degree program? What are you hoping to get a PhD in?
Yes, I'm a PhD student in TEFL, and I'm particularly working on computer-assisted language learning and in teacher education. How to teach language teachers to integrate technology in their teaching.
Okay. What aspect of that are you interested in?
I'm really interested in finding about a professional identity of call teachers, the way that it is developed, the way that they can learn how to integrate technology not based on technocentricism, not based on learning how to work with a tool, but rather how to develop some identity in themselves in order to see how they can learn wherever they are in each situation they are and develop themselves professionally.
Yeah, that's very important, I think. That's and that's kind of what I'm interested in myself. So, okay. So, what were your questions?
First of all, I would like to know about some biographical questions about you. How long have you been teaching English, and also have you been training and helping teachers to develop themselves?
Okay, I started teaching English in about 1974, maybe or something like that. And so that's 25 years last century and 20 years this century. Is this what, 40, 45 years, something like that? Let's see, I got my, I guess I started teaching other teachers when I was working in Saudi Arabia. And this was in 1978 maybe, or 79. 78, I think, and someone brought a computer, a big mainframe computer, down to the language center and set it up there. And it just sat there and did nothing, and I just went over to it and kind of like you'd play a piano, I just kind of started fiddling with the keys. And my director came by and saw me doing that, so he put me in charge of the program that they were trying to develop, put some English lessons on that computer. So I didn't really know anything about it, but someone gave me a manual, and I read a little ahead in the manual, and I was able to organize teachers to develop some English lessons. So I guess that might be the first real training I've done. So since then, since I got my MA, that was in 1985, I started, I was instrumental in getting the computer-assisted language learning interest section started in TESOL, so a lot of that had a lot to do with helping other teachers learn about CALL, computer-assisted language learning. And I suppose in 1998 I started something called Webheads, that is I was working in Oman for 10 years, and then I went back to the United States, and I got a job in a software company. And that was the first time I'd been out of teaching for all that time. So that would have been about 20 years. And so I got involved in online teaching, and this developed. Actually, I got a job in California at the time, but I got a job in the United Arab Emirates to set up a language school, a military language institute, and my job was to train people in CAL. So at that time, when I started the online webheads, writing for webheads, I called it, and up until about 2001, when I was in the United Arab Emirates, but training teachers to use CAL, the webheads had developed into a community of practice of students, and it was also attracting other teachers. And we were going out to conferences and giving demonstrations of what we were doing and how we were engaging students online, in online environments, and in much the way that you've just described as the focus of your dissertation. Because whereas when I did the project in Saudi Arabia, it was really kind of didactic. What teachers were doing, were taking the exercises that we're doing in the book and putting them on, you know, kind of copying them into a computer. And so basically, computer-assisted language learning back then was not as well understood as it is today, and it has had none of the social aspects. So by the time I got through Webheads in Action, or Webheads, I should say, Webheads was kind of getting students to come online and just engage with each other and with teachers and put video, audio, anything they wanted online, pictures. Basically, I called it writing for Webheads, but it was just, they were writing about whatever they wanted to do. And I was setting what they were doing up on a Web 1 website. So this was the thing that, and using the voice application, we were using synchronous voice back in at the turn of the century. This is what attracted other teachers to it. So I suppose my teacher training really got hot in 2001, when I started setting up a Webheads in Action Electronic Village Online session. Are you familiar with EVO, Electronic Village Online?
Of course, I have already taken some courses in EVO with Dr. Nelly Deutsch.
Oh, okay.
She's one of the four teachers.
She's leading. She's the head coordinator of EVO at the moment. Okay. So anyway, Webheads in Action was an EVO session in 2002, which was the second year that EVO ran. And Webheads in Action formed a community of practice of educators, which Susan Mirandy joined. If you go to the Webheads in Action, you're going to go to webheads.info, and you can see Susan's picture there. She was a member of our community. And then I met her in Fukuoka in Japan. She went to the World Call conference there. And so it was a nice mix of online blending into real life learning from one another. There were probably about 1,000 people involved in Webheads in Action at one point or another. It still exists. In fact, I just published an article in the Encyclopedia of Teaching English, TEFL, I guess, teaching, I'm not sure what they call it, maybe EFL, English as a Foreign Language. Anyway, I can't remember the acronym they use, but it's an encyclopedia that just came out from Wiley. And I just saw it in the last TESOL conference in Chicago, but there's an article there on Webheads. So Webheads is now a valid entry in a published encyclopedia. So it's a recognized entity. It's been going for the last 20 years or so. 20 years.
Mm-hmm. In fact, long time.
Yeah, we're in the... this September will be our 20th anniversary. I just now thought of it. So yeah, we'll have to celebrate. See if we can involve.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Okay. So anyhow, that's teacher training the way I kind of like to do it, and the way to do it is to David Cormier, I don't know if you know David Cormier, he's a Canadian researcher, instrumental in MOOCs. Actually, he coined the term MOOC, Massive Open Online Course, and I'm sure you're familiar with MOOCs. It's taken the world by storm in a way. So David Cormier came up with that acronym, MOOC, or he and Brian Alexander, there's some controversies, but anyway, neither of them will say now who actually invented it. But in any event, he calls, in his last MOOCs, one of them was focused on community as curriculum. So basically, it's the community that establishes what they want to do in the class. And that's what, that's the kind of language, that's the model that I used with WebEds in Action back in 1998. Community as curriculum, the community members set down what they wanted to do and interacted around that, whatever they had in mind. And WebHeads has always done that too. I've always been known as the cat herder of WebHeads because I never tell anybody what they should do. They just do whatever they want to do and they learn from one another. And most recently, for the last 4 or 5 years, I've been getting into Minecraft. Are you familiar with Minecraft?
Not completely, almost. I've heard about it, but I haven't experienced it.
Yeah, it's a game. I'm starting actually to get the people where I work interested. We're starting a Minecraft exploration group. It addresses what you're researching, and that is, instead of coming at language learning from the point of view of you've got to teach people the grammar, you've got to do step A, step B, etc. It puts people, whether they're students or teachers, into a communicative environment where they each person has his own agenda, and they work with one another and have fun doing it and learn from one another. Minecraft lends itself to just about anything you want to teach. If you want to teach language, it's a very good substrate for communication because it encourages creativity and problem solving and critical thinking skills. And so if you can exploit the communication around that, then you can address language learning issues. And then just about any other topic as well, if Minecraft Edu has lots of worlds devoted to chemistry, for example. I just happened to notice that because I was looking through the worlds to see what, if anything, would lend itself to our situation. But anyway, that's the philosophy that's been behind all of these efforts. All my teaching training efforts is not really prescribing workshops that would work this way or another, but sort of say we're going to get together and do this or learn about the tools like the ones we're doing right now. And so you might have a purpose that isn't really the purpose of what you're trying to do. For example, let's get together and play Minecraft. Oh boy, this looks like fun. But what we're really trying to do is learn about gamification and how we can apply that to our students. So gamification is something, it's kind of like cello. You have to taste it. You can't describe it. So you need to experience it.
Right. Yes. Okay, thank you so much. That was a great history. And it's really inspiring. Really, really inspiring. Yes. And I realized that you use Blackboard Collaborate among other devices that you use. I would like to know these major devices and perhaps the theoretical perspectives or the learning theory you consider behind using them.
When you say devices, do you mean the software tools like this one?
Sorry, the tools, software, yes, or different conferencing tools, different LMSs, for instance.
Yes, for a while I was kind of hooked on something called do-it-yourself LMS, DIY LMS. So it's sort of encouraging people to, instead of say go with one thing like Blackboard, for example, which is expensive, or as Nelly would suggest, why not just use Moodle, which is free and does pretty much the same thing as Blackboard. So that's kind of getting you in toward a do-it-yourself LMS, because you can install Moodle and you could use it for a lot of LMS features. But I use wikis quite a lot. I like PBWorks in particular. PBWorks is very robust, and I use it to organize all my face-to-face courses. So I always set up I have a PBWorks, I call it Vance's class at pbworks.com. So if you go to vancesclass.pbworks.com, you can see what I'm teaching, what I've been teaching, where I have been for the last 5 or 6, 7 years. So anyway, that's a way of organizing what I'm doing so that students can go to a link and see if they miss a class, they can see what they missed. If they can't tell you they didn't understand the assignment, it's always there, you know, everything is there. You know, all the resources they need are there. Click on it, everything is uploaded there, they can download it. Or there's a link to where they can get it. And that link, in fact, could be to Blackboard, because we use Blackboard here, so sometimes I just link to things in Blackboard, which are, they have to have their password, but at least it's there organized for them. So if they go to Blackboard, there's a big, huge text wall. There's a wall of text that they have to get through and find things. But if you go to Vance's class, and you're in my class, you can just go there and you can see, well, this is what we did on Tuesday. Click here, you know, and do that. So there we got two devices mentioned just now. Blackboard could be one, or Moodle. Call it Moodle because it's free and open source. And so you could have that, and then you could have your own little, this is my class, wiki going. In fact, actually, I was teaching a course for TESOL and the TESOL Principles and Practices of Online Teaching program, and it was on multiliteracies. I don't know if you're familiar with multiliteracies. If someone asked you to teach a course on multiliteracies, would you know what to do?
Not quite.
Okay, I didn't either. Because someone asked me to teach a course on multiliteracies, and I wasn't sure. I'll do that. What is it? So I went and figured it out. I read some things about it, and I found out that it was a way of dealing with Web 2.0, or there's so many aspects to it, but basically being literate digitally, being able to converse, to write about, to implement multiliteracies. So it's not just the traditional literacies, but also the literacies that you need in today's day and age. So I was supposed to teach a course on that, and they wanted the courses to be in Desire to Learn, which they had purchased, and and they were paying me not much, just $1,000 a time, you know. This is actually, I mean, for the work you put into it, it's a token, you know. But they, part of what they wanted to do, I think, was develop their Desire to Learn with all the courses that they were putting up there. But I sort of went around it. I used Desire to Learn for as a chat forum, or, you know, but I put the materials, I put them in my own spaces. And, you know, for example, the wiki, or, well, here again, you can go to, I eventually called this Multiliteracies MOOC. And it's got the web page is Goodbye Gutenberg. If you just write Goodbye Gutenberg, and you can spell Gutenberg correctly with one T, so goodbyegutenberg.pbworks.com. You can see archived there all of the iterations, both for the TESOL courses and for the ones that I did after that as EBO sessions. In fact, actually, to keep this course alive, to keep it current, I gave it for some time as both a TESOL paid course and as a free EBO session. I felt I needed to do that because it's not something that you could actually just say come into when they wanted it and when they gave you a Desire to Learn. They used to give me about a month's lead time, or maybe even less, maybe a couple of weeks. So you're supposed to, they give you, they open up your Desire to Learn space, you're supposed to put your course up there and then run the course in kind of the Blackboard way, and everybody enrolls there. But I was always kind of doing the course off in another space, which I was then using again in Electronic Village and coming back to the Principles and Practices course. So I think they kind of didn't like that, and they dropped me from the program. But I had interesting interactions with some of the people. I think they sent some of the people in the TESOL program took my course. I think were checking me out, perhaps, to see what was going on. So it was certainly different. It was not the way that most courses were run. But some of those people who were in that course are still in Webheads, are still my friends. Mark Algren was one of them. He was president of TESOL for a while. So it was a different way of running a course. So it encompassed all of the tools you just mentioned, the Blackboard Collaborate, if that's the best way to do it, or this, what we're doing right now, using Skype, voice and video. It works quite well. Only problem is it's not social. Skype, that's the main drawback with Skype. It does work well, kind of like Facebook. You could do this on Facebook as well. Facebook is a little bit more social. You can actually bring people into it, but you can't actually invite anyone to come into Facebook and have a look. Or can you? I don't know. You get a link, and anybody, yeah, I think anybody can join, can't they?
Yes, yeah. We can make a group chat, yes.
Yeah, kind of difficult to do that on Skype, though. So we didn't really set this up socially, but another thing that I do as far as teacher training is concerned is Learning Together, which is, you go to learningtogether.net, that's learning with a number two, together.net. If you go there, you can see the podcasts I've been doing. This would be number 392, something like that, so almost 400 podcasts since 2010. A little fewer than one a week, and I've been tapering off lately because I've, Learning Together is this podcast that's social. I had a little discussion with Nellie the other day. She said it was a wiki. I said, no, it's a social network. And then as we started conversing, I noticed, for example, she tweeted one of them, and so I tweeted back and said, ah, you see, it's a social network. Now that's a good example of how to combine the tools. What devices or tools do I use? I have a Facebook page for Learning Together. I have a Google Plus community. When I create, I didn't actually set this one up like that, but some of those other ones that I showed you, I did. It depends on where you have it. In Skype, or if you're not sure where you're going to have it, you can't really announce it. But if I had done that, or if you wanted to come back to us and tell us about your dissertation once you've done it, or once you're well along in it, you have something you'd like to share with us, then we would announce your event on my wiki, and I would then announce it on Facebook, Google Plus communities. These reach a lot of people. Google Plus community is quite powerful because a lot of people are Google Plus members, and I announce things once I've done them. Scoop It is a really nice site for because when it creates a kind of an archive where people can go to. You can actually go to learningtogether.scoopit.com, and you can see a nice display of our recent podcasts. When you announce there, it also announces on Google Plus and on Twitter what you've done. So I get a lot of traffic that way. That increases the social network. And because if we're using Google Hangout, then it goes to YouTube. Or if I put something up on YouTube, like, for example, if you gave me permission, I could upload this video to YouTube if you wanted, but only with your permission, of course. But you can do that offline. You don't have to do it now. But that would then create another social aspect. So you'd get traffic from that, and people would then come to your page. So and people would learn about it, and the network expands in that way. So this networked learning is quite powerful, and if you can get one going, a social network going. Nellie's trying to set one up now. She's just invented a place that she wants to make social. We'll see if she succeeds. Crossing from the idea of it to the social aspects takes a lot of just people going viral. It takes a lot of virality to it. So that's a magic ingredient.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. And about your student teachers, the teachers that you are trying to teach them how to integrate technology in their teaching, I would like to know how they develop that confidence and efficacy of using technology in their teaching. What happens in them that they develop and gain this confidence?
That's a very good question. When I put training sessions on, whether it's with through TESOL or through Electronic Village Online, I guess the people who self-select to join our courses in Electronic Village Online probably are predisposed in some way. First of all, they're taking on an online course, so they must have some skills. They don't usually come into this without skills. But let's take a really good example to give would be the TESOL courses I was giving versus the Electronic Village courses of multiliteracies. And some people, Lane Marshall is a good example. She was skeptical as she went through one of the TESOL courses. And she was one of the only ones who actually became enthused about the method in that particular iteration. There were probably about a dozen people there. But I would say she's a very good example of someone who learned the power of the tools in the course and then went on to develop these herself. Now she's she's kind of a guru in flipped learning, her flipped learning courses, and which goes back, that's the same kind of tool set. You know, if you're going to promote flipped learning or use it in your teaching, then you need to have a good grasp of all of these tools because you're teaching, you're putting things online so that students can get it in their own time. And when they come to class, you're trying to use that for discussion if possible. So you cover the concepts in the flipped part of it. Or if the students aren't prepared, then they can prepare in class while you're working with the students who got it, you know. So, but as far as the training that I've done, another good example of, just to illustrate the concept, because this illustration is actually more powerful, I think, than explaining. But I mentioned that I was teaching teachers in our program how to use Minecraft, which is a very difficult concept. This gamification, I said, the reason we're in Minecraft is so we're trying to learn about gamification, because you just cannot understand it until you experience it. And so I asked people where I work, I said, look, I've got 20 licenses. If you want one, we're going to start a Minecraft exploration group. If you want one, let me know. And I got back about 6 or 8 people out of the 30 or 40, well, maybe counting the other, maybe probably 70 or 80 teachers there. So 10% of them said, yeah, okay, I'd like to know more about this. And then as the group got together, half of those teachers never responded to anything I put out, but a couple of them, say two to four, something like that, are really, we say, biting the Kool-Aid. You know, they're taking the drug. You know, they're addicted. They're getting into it now. So there's your seed. So I've got flowers are starting to bloom. Other people might see the flowers and say, oh, I want to be a flower too, you know. Or they'll continue to ignore it, or they don't understand the concept. Because, you know, this small group of people are asking me, what's the point? Okay, this is interesting. What's the point? Why are we doing this? You know, how can... And then I have to go back and I can take examples of what students have done. Here's one student who made a house, and he described why he did the house this way. And so he created it in Minecraft, had fun doing that. Then he wrote something about it, described his process. So now there's a very clear example of using language in Minecraft. And later on, he also made a machine that did things in Minecraft. But I couldn't get him to write about it because of just the nature of the course. It wasn't really a course I was doing. I was just working with students. But if you build this in your curriculum, then even the teachers, as they're working together, the teachers are asking me, how do I do this or that? And let's look at the example. How do I make map? I want to make a map in Minecraft. I want to see the world I'm in. I didn't actually know the answer to the question myself, so I looked it up on Google or on YouTube, and I found the answer. You need to get some paper and what else do you need? A compass. You need some compass and a paper. And the YouTube video shows you very quickly how to get paper, cut down some cane that's growing around, and then from that put two together or three together and you get some paper. So then to make a compass, you need some redstone, which is a little harder to come by. It's power in Minecraft. Anyway, you get that and some metal, and then you can make a compass. Okay, so you get those two things together, and then you just hold it up in a certain way, and you walk around, and it puts a map on the paper, so you can map your environment. So this is a nice question that he asked me, how can I make a map? And so we look it up together, and we figure out how to do it, and then, of course, you're going to have to build something that will display the map. Just that aspect, you know, people are always. Oh, another question he asked was where's the recipe book? The recipe book is in Google. You just write how to make a in Minecraft, and you just keep a window open, and anything you need, you just put something for a knife. Put a knife in there. How do I make a knife in Minecraft? I don't think there is a knife, sword. That's more. It shows you how to do it. So you can keep that recipe book handy there and as you play the game. So you're always having to research, learn more about the game. And one of the aviation science teachers wanted to, he was teaching survival. He said, how can I teach this in my survival training? I mean, Minecraft has two modes, creative and survival. Duh, you know. Survival, it's right there in Minecraft. But he says, well, it's too difficult to teach my students to do this. How are we going to... Because, of course, he doesn't want to do that in his course. He wants to teach them the subject. You know, how do they survive airplane crashes? They're going to be pilots. So, here's a job for the English teachers. The English teachers can teach them how to do all this stuff and be doing language. And, they take that knowledge into their survival class. And then it really works together, I think, in my mind. But it's very difficult for teachers to get this concept. So, you basically have to get some people. You can talk about it till we say you're blue in the face, you know, holding your breath. And so you can talk about it, and no one will really pay much attention. Actually, the way it got working in my course was that one of my colleagues, Jeff Kuhn, and I wrote an article that got published in TESOL Journal. No one in where I work ever read that, but the dean was interested in this in gamification, and he actually read my article, our article, and he became a convert. And now he's trying to push it in the school. So it's just all these little, you know, I've been writing and talking about this for years, and nothing ever happens. It's difficult to, but once it starts happening, once you've got the spark, you've got flame, flowers. So you just got to get people involved and get them doing it, get them interested and doing things that they might be using tools to do other things. So like, putting up a web page for their students is just, they might think, let's just put a text page down, but once you start bringing in multimedia into it, and links and all this, where all this goes, and flipping it and using it to flip your classes. I mean, it just goes, people learn a lot about technology just putting that together, and then once they've learned it, it's theirs.
Yeah, thank you so much. And what do your student teachers do when they get in trouble, when there is a connection breakdown, technology breakdown? How do they can gain the confidence and efficacy of troubleshooting?
The answer to that is communities, and communities of practice. So when you can't do this in a vacuum, like another taking the Minecraft example, that's something I'm doing right now. We need to get our computers into talking to each other. So we need to play in multiplayer mode. It's not working where we are right now. The computers themselves run Minecraft, but this computer can see this one over here, but the communication doesn't happen. So I started with our network specialist where I am, and they went up and they start talking to us. Okay, never mind. I need to go to my community. So this is actually something I was talking about just yesterday at work, but I need to go to my community. I need to write people there and say, look, I've got this problem. What can I do? You know, and the 3,000 people in Minecraft education might help me. Somebody there might help. Or the closer-knit EVO Minecraft MOOC that's got a few hundred people, there are people there. Somebody will help. So you have to have a personal learning network. And that's part of, what we're doing using these devices and talking about social networks. It's not just you and your students or you and your teachers sitting around you. It's going outside to develop your networks. Stephen Downs says that that whatever is knowledge that's in the network is yours as long as you're connected. George Siemens says that the importance of the network is not, it's not the knowledge, it's the pipes. He called it the pipes. So there might be water. You might not have water in your house, but if there's water over there and you've got pipes, you can bring it. Or, you know, anyway, but that's kind of a, for knowledge, whatever you're trying to find out about, someone knows about it, and if you're connected, even to someone who knows that person, then it's in your network. So you can solve problems that way. That's the best way, is to however you develop your network, whether it's a network of teachers in your institution or whether it's a professional organization that might be just in where you are in Iran, or where Susan is, I'm sure, well connected to other teachers elsewhere in Iran, or how you're finding me, for example. So that's to use that in your dissertation. So, you know, that's how you do it.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much. I would like to know about the roles of call teachers. Are there any differences between the roles of a call teacher and the roles of a teacher in a regular class?
What do you mean by a call teacher? Do you mean someone who teaches computer-assisted learning to other teachers, or someone who uses computer-assisted language learning in their classes? What do you mean by a call teacher?
It can include both. It can include a call teacher, a person who teaches English language through technology, and a call teacher educator.
Well, it's, you know, computer-assisted language learning also, to get really to the root of that question, everything is computer-assisted. So it's kind of hard to distinguish. Yeah, I don't know if you have teachers who don't use any technology. Most teachers will at least maybe use an overhead projector, or even a piece of chalk is technology. But computer assisted, there's if you use cell phones, that's
look at your students.
What are your students doing? I mean, they must be. Iran is famous for its social networking. So my impression is that everybody there has a cell phone. Am I right?
Yes, exactly. My students are equipped with cell phone and laptops, and also I put some of the assignments on a social network, on a group. They are in a group, and kind of flip learning. The session after that, they are going to discuss something different, movies, different tasks. And also we've got, yes, overhead projector, every class is equipped. That's the bottom line. And now we've got, they are equipped with mobile in the class. They search something.
So everything is already computer assisted. But the problem is when teachers approach this computer-assisted environment and haven't made the paradigm shift. You know, they're thinking in the old way, the old didactic models, and they're not utilizing the technology in ways that are obvious or not so obvious to some. I mean, even students who are supposed to be so attuned to technology are famously not aware of also the power of learning that can be in the tools. They use them to entertain themselves. So teachers can also, well, I mean, if computer-assisted language learning means creating PowerPoints for your classes, that's good. That's better than the old way, but by old way, I'm talking 20 years old. But say 10 years ago, you would shift. Well, for one, if you're making PowerPoints, for example, that means they're just on your computer. So you could either upload them to SlideShare, or even better, you could use Google Slides instead. So you could make your PowerPoints accessible to students, and perhaps even invite the students to write on them, or ask questions, or post comments. So, you know, there are, I suppose a Cal teacher would be someone who is aware of many, the multiliteracies, the multiliterate teachers, someone who is aware of all the aspects involved, and who can help others to understand those aspects beyond the level they're already at. So, I mean, everybody is at a different stage. So, for example, one thing that I talk about, I encourage people to think small. Think small means social media assisted language learning. So instead of talking about computer assisted language learning, which doesn't really mean anything anymore, social media assisted language learning, and some people call it MAL, mobile assisted language learning. So how do you get the students to use in class what they've got in their pockets? So you can use polls, for example. There's something where you can give students a card and they can turn it four different ways and it comes out with four different A, B, C, and D, but it's, you know, they select the answers by turning the cards. So you can scan with your mobile and get answers. So you can set up questions and answers for students that way. Games like Kahoot, pretty simple, and I know these work well in classes until they get tiring. But anyway, there are ways to jazz up your class, and I think polls is really one really good example. There's so many of them. Nearpod. Anyway, there's poll-based learning environments that I guess maybe Nearpod. That's a good one. So much you can do with Nearpod, for example. Edmodo as a learning management system. There are many tools, and they have their different affordances. Affordances, if I write that into my anything that's spell checking, it never knows the spelling of affordances. So it's a word, I guess, that some people, even myself, the first time I heard it, maybe 20 years ago, I didn't really understand what is he talking about. So it's the thing that device makes possible. What that device makes possible, that's the affordances. So each device has certain affordances, and you have to be aware of them. And it's really easy to use something and not be aware of its affordances and not really exploit its full power. So the role of a call teacher or a call trainer is someone who becomes aware of affordances and can teach them. In fact, you know, there's a guy named David Warlick talks about master teachers and master learners. Master learners. Okay, if I go back to Stephen Downs, says that teachers demonstrate and what is it? Something and demonstrate students practice and reflect. Students practice and reflect. Teachers. What was the other thing in demonstrate? Oh, I can't remember the fourth thing, but anyway, basically, a master learner is someone who does all four of those things. He can demonstrate, reflect, practice, and whatever the fourth one is, something that teachers do. So, I like this master learner concept because it means, especially for languages, it means that you're not really a teacher. You're someone who's learned how to do all those things, and you can then show other people how to be master learners as well. And but you have, it's like making coffee. Good coffee is percolation, so you have to have all of those things. You're whatever it is, explaining, demonstrating, reflecting, and practicing all the time. As a teacher, you're doing that. We're doing that right now. We're learning from each other. So we're practicing, and we're reflecting on what we're doing by talking about what we do. And we're also, as teachers, we demonstrate, model. A teacher models, demonstrates. Students practice and reflect. So a master teacher, a master learner, not a master teacher, a master learner does all four of those things, models, practices, reflects, and demonstrates. So, and that's what teachers need to become, master learners. That's what they're good
master
at.
Yeah, thank you. And what about the constraints and different challenges that call teachers or teachers who use technology in their language teaching, what kind of challenges do you think they face? Maybe your student teachers come to you and talk about different, for example, challenges, different issues, ethical issues, administrative challenges that they face. What are the major challenges they face?
Well, one of them is anxiety over their lack of knowledge, because mm-hmm. all of us have that. All of us lack knowledge in something. Let's say, for example, there's a lot of learning systems are talking about blockchain nowadays. So blockchain is what gives Bitcoin its value. It's a way of establishing through a ledger system the validity of something and ownership. But blockchain, in ways that escape me at the moment, have a lot of people are building educational systems on blockchain. So now as that becomes more and more important, some of us are going to become anxious because we don't really know how this works. So there's always, technology is always moving, and that shifting paradigm shifts, is always going to be hard for teachers to get their feet on, and to get their footing, I should say. So, but you have to keep trying, and you have to keep engaging, and keep learning, and keep practicing. You have to be practicing, reflecting, then get out and model and demonstrate what you've learned, and that keeps you, if you do that enough, and don't hide from it. And but from practical aspects, I would say that a lot of teachers feel overwhelmed, and they don't even want to get started. They don't know where to get started. They worry that their students might know more than them. So now Minecraft is a good example of that. The best way to approach that dilemma is to go play Minecraft with your students and get them to show you. So you need to, the mind shift that you need, the paradigm shift is that you're not the font of all knowledge. That knowledge is everywhere in the network. Your network could be your students. So you could do projects where students could help you crack some of the more insurmountable objects, insurmountable problems that you have. So there are simple problems, there are complicated problems, there are complex problems, and there are wicked problems. And so simple and complicated problems are usually not too hard to figure out, but as we're getting up into gamification, we're getting complex. And then if you get wicked, that's, you know, that's harder. This blockchain right now is a wicked problem for me, I suppose. Anyway, so learning how, you know, that's the framework. It doesn't really mean much to a teacher, but the teacher will have a, well, one way you can do it, one thing I do is I put tutorials up. So, for example, my teachers are, every term they have to write reports on students, and so I create Excel files and do mine by mail merge, and the reports just come out pretty quickly, and now I'm showing teachers how to do it. So that's kind of a complicated problem, maybe even complex in some aspects, but I put tutorials up to show them how to do it. I give them workshops, or I just show them how to do it when they need to know. Just-in-time learning is very important. JIT, just-in-time learning, is you have to hit people at the right time when they need the information. And I always make tutorials and put them up at my wikis. If you want to see my tutorials, KBZPD, I work at a place called, named after Sheikh Khalifa bin Zayed, professional development. And .pbworks.com, kbzpd.pbworks.com. And then you can see the tutorials I've put up for teachers in my present work. And so I just, we also have a, I'm a chair of a professional development committee there. So here again, I try to put things up online. People are always coming to me and asking what professional development did we do. I have a database. I have a Google Sheet with all that information, so I just point them there, and they don't have to come to me. They can go there and find out what they went to. And so, you know, there's lots of ways of working that you model. I'm modeling in this case. And, you know, some people will reflect and actually learn to do it themselves. So, you know, just keep things available. In a previous place I worked in the Military Language Institute, when I came to Abu Dhabi in 1997, I made a website called Ask Vance, and it was quite famous where I was working. If you want to know something, just ask Vance, and they would just go to my pages and find out just whatever. I just recorded everything there, that frequently asked questions, you know. Well, another thing too. So one lady asked me, one of my colleagues asked me, I need to, how do you do something with Audio Boo or Audacity? I can't remember what it was. I said, well, why don't you just Google it? She said, what? Google it? I said, yeah, you just put KBZAD, or, you know, put my name and Google it. And she put it in there, and it brought up the wiki that I had prepared. And so there it is, right there. So, you know, when you put things in that kind of open space, as opposed to Blackboard, where you'll never find anything, then, you know, it just opens up a different mindset, you know, that people, instead of being closed and enterprise and locked down, open it up, share it, and everybody benefits. You develop your network that way.
Good. Yeah, very good. Thank you so much. I've got to my final question, but I think it's already been answered among your different answers. I repeat it, if you want to add something, it is already answered. I would like to know about the ways that teachers who use technology in their teaching, or even educators, can improve and update their knowledge and skills of using and integrating technology in teaching.
How will they use it? How will they use their what they know about technology?
Yes, how they can improve their knowledge, their technological knowledge.
Well, they in the four ways. Yes. They practice, reflect, demonstrate, model it. So then they take, they reflect on the models, and they use it when they need it. They learn how to do it when they need it. You can, if you're trying to do something like create, let's say, if you want to make, there's something called hot potatoes, which is a way of creating some closed passages. So what I do is I get some sound files, and I put them at the top of the hot potatoes, and the student plays the sound file and fills in the close from what he hears, he or she. And so that requires that you know a little HTML so that you can, and you put the audio file somewhere in the neighborhood of the hot potatoes files, so it becomes part of, you incorporate that sound file in the package. And then if you have to also find a player or a code that will play on just about any device. And so once you do that, then you can create these exercises. But if it's something that is useful to a program, then you want to get other teachers to do it. So instead of just you doing them all, it's get other teachers to have to teach that to the people. So when people see if that is useful and they want more of it, then they'll have to learn how to do it, because I can't do them all. So so you know, I think that's how people, that's one way people increase technology. It's just another example. So you know, you find, I think teachers are always modeling to each other also. So what works in one class, teachers will want to know more about that. Maybe a good way to answer that question is there needs to be a means for teachers to share what they're doing. Like we have occasional workshops, professional development workshops, or even if we used to have something we called homegrown Cal. So homegrown means what our teachers have discovered in our environment, and we would create a time that they could have each week to make presentations to one another. That worked really well. They really liked hearing from one another and learning from one another. So that again uses the master learner model, where the teachers themselves are demonstrating to others and modeling to others what they should do, and everyone is learning about that, reflecting on it. If they wanted to use it, they'll practice it themselves and then take it to the next level and model something else for somebody, for their peers again.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. That was a great contribution, and I learned a lot, in fact.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and thank you very much.
I'm even more inspired. Yeah, thank you. And thank you so much for the time you shared with me. I have no other question. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Well, nice to meet you, and say hi to Susan. And
sure.
Yeah.
And okay. Nice to meet you too. That was a great chance for me. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, I hope the recording came out. I just noticed I had the audio down, but I did a test, so it should work. So anyway, okay. Well, thank you very much. And
well, thank you, and have a nice day. And really, it's a really big help, and I learned a lot. Thank you.
Okay. All right, okay. So I'll stop the recording.